Okay, so you have all that going on. Then, you know what? I think I'll leave time for some questions now, and then then maybe tomorrow I'll talk a little bit about some of the things that happened once the scriptures started getting written down, because that's really interesting how that began to affect how Buddhism is practiced and taught. Okay. So I hope, you know, the program is preparing for monastic life, and what I'm trying to do is somehow by teaching the history of it, show you how monastic life and practice developed over the centuries, and also show you a little bit about how, because in our monastic practice, we're all united, like I was saying at that conference, by our practice of the Vinaya. And if you can understand the history and these developments, then you always find a way to come back to what's common in all the traditions so that, you know, as a Sangha of the four quarters with, you know, Sangha from whatever Buddhist tradition, we know what we have in common and what we can practice in common and how to relate. You know, maybe if we do bodhisattva practice and tantric practice, how to trace that back to actually what's found in the Pali Canon so that we can, when we interface with people in different Buddhist traditions, really see the common things and be respectful of the traditions and really feel like one big Buddhist family instead of getting into this thing of I'm a this and you're a that and, you know, our traditions are so different and all this kind of nonsense. Questions? Yeah.
I have a question. I was reading somewhere and I can't remember the source, this whole thing of the development of like making offerings to stupas and scriptures and all that. And what I was reading was saying it was like this was a Mahayana development that sort of corresponded with the people were starting to lose faith in the Sangha, like the Sangha, maybe morality was starting to degenerate, this whole thing of the institution was becoming more important than their realizations, and they were kind of, the lay people were like looking at the Sangha and not finding them so much an object of veneration, so then they moved their veneration towards these holy objects. Is that, and then this whole thing also about like the emphasis in the Mahayana about lay people able to get the realizations, like the whole de-emphasis of the Sangha, is that?
Okay, so what you find, you know, when the historians talk about the development and going and the rise of the Mahayana, is they often mention people losing faith in the Sangha and the empowering of lay people to practice. And what I've read too also is that what started to happen is the Sangha became a kind of an elite group. Yeah, and it was like, okay, we're monastics and we do this special practice and the lay people, their job is to support us, is dana, you know? And of course, the lay people, they want to practice too. And if they just begin to see that the only thing that they can do is to support the Sangha to create merit for their own good rebirth, and they feel like their avenues for actual Dharma practice are limited, then there can be a real reaction to this. Yeah? So, you know, that's what, when I read too, what I heard was happening. And so, it seemed like in one way Mahayana was opening the door more to lay practitioners, because you could be a bodhisattva without being a monastic. Yeah? Because remember going back to the Staviravada Mahasanghika split? One of the questions there was, could lay people even attain arhatship? And it's interesting now when, you know, I talk with my Theravada friends, they say that there is the view in Theravada even nowadays that lay people can become an arhat, but they have to ordain within 7 days of becoming an arhat. Otherwise, they're going to die because the support of a lay person is not sufficient to hold the energy of being an arhat. Yeah? So, you know, you can see that as a cultural movement, if you start having the Sangha becoming too much of an elite, that you know, holds itself above the lay people, then of course there's going to be a backlash. And so the Mahayana could be seen as that kind of backlash of opening up the doors. Now you have Ambalakirti, who, you know, kind of makes Shariputra look a little bit silly. But you know, what's interesting is that at the beginning of the Mahayana Sutras, the lay bodhisattvas are always very respectful of the Sangha, okay? And very much, you know, in the bodhisattva vows, it teaches a lot about respecting the Sangha, you know, and how important that is. And what I find interesting is the way I've always learned it is that bodhisattva vows, you know, they're taken on the basis of any of the pratimoksha vows. You could have the five lay precepts or, you know, or monastic vows or whatever. So they're open to everybody to take, and that it's still very important to respect the Sangha. But that, I think that might be more unique to the Galupa view, because but you know, if you really look in the Tibetan society, also in Galupa, but maybe less in Galupa, that you already had in Tibet, you know, so many lay teachers in all the traditions, you know, and sometimes the highest teachers in a particular tradition are lay teachers who are married with a family. Okay, so you had that happening in Tibet actually for many, many centuries. And you've had it happening in Japan for many, many centuries. When you encounter people who practice Chinese Buddhism, they're very much shocked by this. How, you know, they're saying, how can lamas be lay people, you know? Because in China, then even though you practice the Bodhisattva vehicle, you know, the teachers were always the Sangha, and they have very high regard for the Sangha. Okay, but in Tibet already you had more lay people, you know, having high realizations and being very highly respected teachers. And so I think that's what's in a way led to, in the West now, the spread of Buddhism to the West, you have so many lay teachers, and it's very much accepted because that was also happening in Tibet. Yeah, it wasn't something new. Whereas Chinese Buddhism coming to America, the emphasis is still really on the monastics. And general Theravada, you know, the Abhayagiri folks, there the emphasis is on monastics. But then the IMS thing, that's kind of like the backlash against that. Because those people, you know, went to Burma, and they learned the practice. They didn't want to ordain. They didn't want, like, the precepts and all the ceremonies, so they brought it back just as a meditation technique, yeah, without precepts and without monastics, yeah? So in some way that was, you know, more inclusive of the lay people. So I think you have this thing kind of going on all throughout Buddhist history of, you know, sometimes they're becoming elites, and then a new movement comes and really says, no, we want it more widespread. But then, I mean, it leads to interesting reactions, because at this monastic conference, we had a huge discussion about what is Buddhism in America going to be in 100 years if the monastic community is not established here. What's it going to be? Is it going to be anything? Yeah, is it? Are we really going to have, you know, a solid tradition here without a Western community, a Western Buddhist monastic community? And where's this going to come from? If there, you know, there's so many lay teachers and not encouraging Vinaya practice, or in some cases not even encouraging precepts, and, you know, teaching different dharma in different ways, and not necessarily even teaching rebirth and karma, which are so essential to the Buddhist tradition. So where's it going to be without the monastic container? Yeah. So we had a big discussion about that. It was quite interesting.
Was there a conclusion, or was there a, like, feeling, general feeling?
Well, all of us just really shared this incredible feeling. I mean, we're all monastics, so we all just really see the value of the monastic life, and, like, who's going to hold the container? Who's going to hold the practice? Who's going to hold the transmission if everything's, if the model of a Buddhist practitioner becomes a Western Dharma teacher who has a house in the suburbs, kids who go to summer camp and wear Nike shoes, a mortgage to pay off, a car payments. If that becomes the example of the highest level of Buddhist practitioner, you know, what happened to what the Buddha taught about, you know, a simple lifestyle and all of this? It's gone. Yeah, and how are people going to practice if that's the model of a Buddhist practitioner? You know, then there's no emphasis at all on being free of the eight worldly concerns. Because the example presented to you is live your comfortable middle-class American lifestyle and practice the Dharma.
And it's that thing that's sort of almost held up as even more virtuous. Oh, like
yeah.
That thing I'm telling you about, that panel discussion in Tucson, and it's one of these teachings, and there's four Ajahnamra, like five lay Dharma teachers that are saying, oh, it's so much better to practice Dharma in daily life, like when your kids are screaming at each other Tuesday morning over pancakes at the breakfast table. Like, there was totally this feeling of, like, monastics are just kind of running away and, you know, hiding, and, like, they're really in the trenches practicing and with their family, and which is so bizarre. It's so weird.
Yep.
And that's a real flavor of, I think, maybe American, especially Dharma practice, it seems like.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's a very Protestant approach.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But what's interesting is if you even trace the history, when these people who are now middle-aged middle-class Dharma teachers with houses and mortgages and kids, when they were in their 20s, then the whole emphasis was on meditation, and let's all go do meditation retreats. Yeah, if you study Buddhism, everybody was going off to do long retreats and do a lot of meditation. Then when they got older, you want to settle down, have a family, then the emphasis on practicing in Dharma with your family came. But most of these people came from my generation, the hippie generation, simple lifestyle, nothing, go out and do long retreats and, you know. And now it's like middle-class American life is the epitome of practice. You know, and some of them will say, you know, yeah, what you said, you know, the monastics are running away. They can't practice lay life. And I'll say, you're absolutely right. I got ordained because I cannot practice as a lay person. There is no possible way I could have stayed in my life that I was living in 1977 and continued with that and have any semblance of a Dharma practice. I could not do that. You can practice with screaming kids. I respect you. You know?
But then the defining term is what is truly Dharma practice.
Right. Exactly. What is truly Dharma practice?
Because, you know, living here at the Abbey, and what I'm experiencing, I would never ever been able to experience. I would have never been able to see the mirroring of my mind by the community of my teacher. I would have never been able to begin to transform some of the really embedded negative habituated patterns, because the lay culture just doesn't, you know, you can't change it, because everybody around you is basically by consensus all living with the same sort of mind. You know, so I can't even imagine what Dharma practice would look like if the monastic tradition doesn't flourish in the West. I can't see the Buddha's teachings upholding with its purity. It's hard enough here with all the conducive circumstances. I can imagine.
Too, I think the mind, like the mind that is grasping at things, it likes to tell itself that if I'm practicing in lay life and I have all these external distractions, that's like really, you know. But what are, in my opinion, if you're in that mind frame, what are you using those external distractions to mask deeper? You know, like, what are you using your kids, you know, are you using your kids as, oh, well, I'm practicing because I'm dealing with the kids screaming over pancakes, but then you're not looking in, like, that's just all, it's, that looks pretty, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It looks good, but it's, are you really, if you could relate that literally and really take that inside, I think that would be one thing, but it was just, because I had a woman that was a Dharma practitioner when I first decided that I was going to just even explore monastic life. And she's like, you should just practice, you know, practicing in daily life anymore. It's hard enough. And I was like, I think that sounds nice, but I don't think that.
Yeah. How do you do that? Yeah. How do you develop the mind of renunciation when you have car payments and car insurance and a house and a mortgage and your boss doesn't want to give you a raise? How do you do that?
And then there's the whole thing of, like, what they talk about at the conference of Chasta Abbey, like, what about the fourth heavenly messenger? Like,
yes.
Where could it just see the corpse and the sick person and the whatever it was and, like, all the suffering? Like, then he saw the monastic. Like, if you just look like Joe, CEO, executive, and you're just trying to blend in, where do people get that inspiration? Like, Lord Buddha had to see the renunciate. And then that's what really triggered his thing of, like, I'm out of here. I got to find out what's going on, because he had to see that person walking mindfully, looking so different from everybody else. Like, this whole thing, mm-hmm. like, oh, let's all just blend in and don't be too weird, because it's all, like, daily life is the thing. Like, those aren't the people. I mean, they come up to talk to me in the airport. They don't come up to talk to somebody in jeans and a t-shirt. Like, they have no idea. And I think mm-hmm. that's so important to think of that aspect of Lord Buddha's life,
yeah.
too. And that's the one, like, hi, that's, there's a point there.
Yeah, the fourth heavenly
yeah.
messenger.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think it's true that to give birth to a child is a virtuous thing because you're giving someone a precious human record.
I think that's a very good way to cover your attachment for a child.
I've heard that said.
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, and if there were a lay couple who was having a child, I would say, oh, it's wonderful your child's going to have a precious human life because you can introduce them to the Dharma. Of course, if a couple's going to have a child, I'm going to present, you know, having the child in that perspective, because then they'll introduce their child to the Dharma and they'll feel good about the Dharma. I'm not going to say, you know, this is all due to sexual attachment and, you know, and birth is, what did they say, a sexually transmitted terminal disease, you know. You know, I'm not going to say that to somebody who's having a baby. You know, it's not very skillful. Okay. But, you know, how do I think of having a baby? I mean, clearly, I mean, sex is due to attachment. I mean, unless you're some incredible bodhisattva. You know, and they do talk about high bodhisattvas, you know, having sex to give birth to a child for a specific purpose. But for the rest of us who are not high bodhisattvas, I mean, come on. It's attachment, isn't it? You know? And it's masked by all this, you know, nice flowery language, you know, for the benefit of all sentient beings, blah, 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 but, you know. This is nice. What's teaching about EML? Teaching EML is I can say this, you know. When I'm teaching, like in Coeur d'Alene, you can't talk this way to people. You know, like, you know. Here I can. Yes.
Are there lay galoot teachers?
There are a few, but the lay galoot teachers, you know, they started just actually since 59 mostly. Mm-hmm. You know, with people coming to the West. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Before that, I never really heard of any, did you?
Mm-hmm.
No, they were all monastics. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, even the Tibetans, you know, so many of them disrobed. And some mm-hmm. of them, I think, because they had such incredible respect for the Dharma. I mean, I know some, like His Holiness asked some lamas to come and teach in Western universities in the early 60s. And some of them disrobed, and it's, if you look at them now, they live like monks. Mm-hmm. And they have monks' minds. And it's because they respected the Sangha and the ordination so much that they disrobed, because they saw that they couldn't keep it very well in the conditions they were living in. Okay? But that was those few. Now you have like the young Tibetans who were just, you know, so eager to come over here on the pretext of learning English so that they can, you know, work in a restaurant washing dishes and make some money and disrobe and have the benefit of the American dream, which makes me so sad, you know. I look at their situation. They don't have language problems. They don't have visa problems. They have so much going for them. And what do they want to do? Come over here and work in a restaurant and make money.
You really see some really wonderful examples of lay teachers, though. You know, like Dogo Khyentse Rinpoche.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Of course. Yeah.
Like, it's really inspiring. Yeah, then I guess someone like that really seems like a high level bodhisattva, you know?
Oh, yeah. So it's like, you know, Khamchul Rinpoche and, you know, Jigden Sakya Rinpoche. And, you know, yeah, you see many examples. Uh-huh.
I wanted to mention that thing about the statues showing up.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Batchelor wrote that was the influence of the Greeks. You know, that where you talk about that Greek influence in
Gandhar.
Yeah. That's when statues first were in the Buddhist tradition. Said in his book about the history of Buddhism. But I have a question that. This seems funny to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So these tantric practitioners who actually have the realizations,
mm-hmm.
and they would use sex as a part of their practice, how about the partner?
Oh, the partner has to be at an equal level. It can't just be, you know, Joe Blow that you picked up off the street. And because there's whole tantric vows about who your partner is if you're doing the consort practice, and it has to be somebody who's also practicing the tantric path, who has very similar, you know, kind of very similar level of realizations.
Then it seems like it really shouldn't happen that there would be a fallout afterwards. I don't want to ask this question directly.
Well,
I think you know what I'm saying.
Yes. Well, what I heard, and I don't know if this is true, but what I heard, and it makes a lot of sense to me, is when His Holiness once was talking to some of the Tibetan lamas about all this cry about, you know, teachers sleeping with their students, His Holiness said, yes, you know, Guru Rinpoche slept with Yeshe Sogya, but, you know, she was a great tantric practitioner, and she didn't complain of sexual abuse afterwards. You know? In other words, if you're sleeping with somebody and they're complaining of sexual abuse afterwards, what are you doing? Yeah? Yeah.
But sometimes, because I read about some West, like Western, one of the first Western women Buddhist monastic conferences or something at Naropa University in the early 80s. It was some conference, I've forgotten the actual word. And all of this stuff about Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche's, like, behavior came out. And it turned out that all the women who were his sexual partners, like, none of them were complaining at all. It was just the other people, like, looking at that, freaking out about it. So I think sometimes even something okay, like I'm not sure at all about him, but like something okay can be going on between the two partners, mm-hmm. but then looking at it from the outside, it was like you said about the tantric thing with this nun trying to explain and nobody really getting it, and then them freaking out. So it even could be that scandals happen and the woman's not saying it's a problem at all, but like all the people looking at it.
You know, the situation, I understand that the situation I was thinking of was the
I mean,
and then the other thing that makes me ask this is because I have a friend in Seattle who works for a nonprofit, and what they work with are all religious traditions around sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
That's in every tradition, every religious tradition in this country.
Yeah.
We do stuff all over the U.S.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, how that was supposed to work.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I was holding one of these Western Buddhist teachers' conferences, he was describing it, and also in the Tantric teachings, I've heard it in that context too. It's when you are at the level of Tantric realizations where, you know, you can drink alcohol and drink pee, and it's the same thing to you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, or where you can, you know, eat excrement and eat chocolate chip cookies and it's the same thing to you, then you're at the level where you can do this. Okay, so that's when Bob Thurman said that we should give all these people the taste test. You know, to see if they can really do these practices. Yeah, and His Holiness made some comment about how it's real curious, you know, how all these people talk about Tantra and, you know, and it says, you know, if you're at a very high level of practice, you can live in a very expensive, luxurious environment and you have no attachment, you're using it for the benefit of sentient beings and it's completely okay. But also at that level of practice, you're completely happy living in the slums of the city. Well, why do all these teachers choose to live in the luxurious places and not the slums? And the concert can appear, you know, I mean, Naropa, his first appearance of Vajrayogini was as an old hag. But how come all these people, you know, they don't go live with old hags, they go live with beautiful young ones? You know? He's just, you know, kind of commenting about how that, just interesting how that happened. Yeah.
I think it would be interesting to know what was different in China that they didn't come up with this flip. Like maybe the way that the monastics were relating with the community.
Okay. I think what happened in China, why this didn't happen, is first of all, Buddhism went to China many centuries earlier than it went to Tibet. Okay, so it went, by the time it got to Tibet, Vajrayana was in full swing in India. But when it was in the process of getting transmitted to China, there was no Vajrayana. So all of this stuff, you know, there is a Vajrayana tradition in Chinese Buddhism, but it came much later. And they really do it very, very quiet, and, you know, because they have incredible respect for the monastic tradition. And so I think one of the factors is when the Buddhism was transmitted there. Then second of all, the Chinese culture. You know, in Confucian culture, people have their roles and they have their places. And ethical conduct was very much emphasized in Confucian culture. You know, the Tibetans were really wild. Yeah?
They are.
Yeah. You know, so just the culture itself, you know, makes it more receptive for one thing or another thing. Yeah. I mean, you have Vajrayana in Japanese Buddhism. Yeah. I mean, the Shingon sect is Vajrayana, but somehow it's not as big of a thing as it has become in Tibet. All of this. We sit quietly.